Grace, you sound like you're feeling well.
Today,
Oh,
anyways.
that's good news. I have your book, Forbidden Archaeology, and I ordered your scientific paper, I guess, that you call My Science and My Religion. And
Yeah,
that.
that's a collection of 24 papers that I've given at mainstream scientific conferences about forbidden archaeology and other topics related to human tell us that humans like us have existed since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth. And when I first learned of those accounts, I had to think, well, should that be accepted as just some kind of mythological concept, or is there perhaps some physical basis for it? And that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology. And when I looked into the history of archaeology, I found that there are many cases of archaeologists, geologists, paleontologists, and other scientists who dig into the earth, finding human bones, human artifacts, human footprints going back many millions of years. So I collected all of those reports in a book of mine called Forbidden Archaeology. And some people might be surprised that I'm able to speak about these things at scientific conferences. I'm not saying that every scientist who hears what I have to say agrees with me. Most of them don't. But it is a fact that I'm able to present things of this type at these mainstream scientific conferences, meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, meetings of the European Association of Archaeologists. So people could either look at my book, like Forbidden Archaeology or The Hidden History of the Human Race, the abridged version of Forbidden Archaeology, or if they want to see how I present this kind of evidence for extreme human antiquity at scientific conferences, they could look at my book, My Science, My Religion, in which I collect many of the scientific papers that I've presented at major international scientific conferences.
And why do scientists disagree with you? It seems to me that you're mostly just presenting facts.
Well, I'm very open about the spiritual inspiration for my work. I'm very open in stating that a lot of my ideas are inspired by my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And for many in the scientific world, they think that you have to keep your spiritual or religious ideas completely separate from any of your scientific ideas. They think those two things should be kept totally apart. I don't necessarily agree with that idea. I think it is proper to say what one's underlying beliefs really are, whether they're atheistic or materialistic or perhaps inspired by some religious or theological concepts. I would agree that in the world of science, one should be prepared to justify one's beliefs or convictions with evidence of the scientific type. So basically, that's what I've been able to do. I acknowledge there is some spiritual background to my ideas, but I'm prepared to justify those ideas in the world of science with scientific evidence. So, of course, this evidence contradicts what many scientists now believe in terms of their concepts of the history of human life. I don't deny that, but you know, sometimes even in the world of science, an idea has to start on a small scale.
It seems to me that science and spirituality are really two sides of the same coin.
Well, I would say that also. I look at myself as being neither a scientist nor a religionist, but a person looking for the truth. And I'm prepared to accept truth wherever I encounter it, be it in terms of scientific evidence or ideas that come from a more spiritual source.
You know, sometimes truth has a kind of shock factor associated with it, don't you think?
Absolutely. And that is one of the things that inspired me as I was getting involved in the kind of research that I do. Yeah, when I first encountered the descriptions in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India of humans existing in the very, very distant past, going back many millions of years, I was inspired to start looking into the history of archaeology, because, you know, if you look in the current textbooks of archaeology and anthropology, you don't see any evidence for extreme human antiquity. You know, you only see the discoveries that are consistent with the dominant paradigm in science today about human origins, namely the Darwinian evolutionary paradigm, which posits that humans like us evolved from more primitive ape-like ancestors fairly recently in the Earth's long geological history. Most scientists today would say that the first humans like us came into existence less than 200,000 years ago. But I thought, well, let me look beyond the textbooks. Let me look at the original scientific reports and see what's actually there. And I thought, maybe I'll do a few days research, 8 days of research, and maybe I'll find a couple of interesting things. But as you say, you know, the truth sometimes has a shock factor to it. When I started actually looking into the original scientific reports, you know, by scientists from the time of Darwin up to the present, I was genuinely shocked to find that there were many cases of scientists reporting finding human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints going back many millions of years. So my 8 days of research turned into 8 weeks, the 8 weeks turned into 8 months, and the 8 months turned into 8 years of research, because one case led to another, and then another, and then another, until finally I had enough evidence to fill up a 900-page book. Forbidden Archaeology. So that to me was shocking, because I didn't, you know, although I thought I should look, I really wasn't expecting to find as much evidence that I did. So yes, there is a kind of shock factor to truth when you come upon it. Yes, indeed, I agree with that.
You know, a lot of the interesting stories that you tell about the Sanskrit writings, talking about flying cities and people from higher levels of reality and extraterrestrials, I find that extremely fascinating. And you've talked to us about a guy named King Shalva. Could you tell us about him again?
Well, you're right. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India speak about a lot of very interesting things. And one thing they tell us about is flying craft, spaceships that were used by human civilizations on this planet and other planets in the universe long ago. Sometimes these accounts go back thousands of years or even millions of years. One of the ones that goes back about 5,000 years happens to be about a king named Shalva on this Earth planet. You know, he lived about 5,000 years ago. And on this planet and on other planets in the universe, there have always been two basic kinds of rulers or populations. Those you could say that were more on the side of darkness, and those who are more on the side of light. I mean, ultimately, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, we're all beings of pure consciousness. None of us are originally from the world of matter. We're now in kind of an alternative reality system for conscious selves that aren't fit to exist on that higher level of reality. Mm. So among the conscious selves on this level of reality, there's one group that's trying to get more and more deeply involved in trying to dominate, control, and exploit the resources of matter for selfish purposes in competition with each other. And they engage in all different kinds of activities that are of that nature. So King Shalva was in that group. On the other hand, there's another group of persons within this world who are trying to understand their nature as beings of pure consciousness. And their attitude towards matter is, let's try to satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, efficient, fair, and equitable way possible, while putting most of our human energy into developing the resource of consciousness. So these two groups have always been in conflict with each other. You know, we can see in the world today there are groups that are trying to increase conflict, exploitation, and then there are groups that are trying to move in another direction. So King Shalva was in this dark group, and he wanted weapons to help him in his efforts. So according to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there's life not only on this planet, but on other planets in the solar system and throughout the universe. And there are even different levels of reality in the cosmos, different dimensions of nature. And they're all inhabited. And basically, you can find these two groups, those on the side of darkness and those on the side of light, throughout the cosmos and at higher levels in the cosmos. So this King Shalva was in touch with Maya Danava, who was the engineer of the forces of darkness at higher levels in the cosmos. And this Maya Danava manufactured a flying machine for King Shalva. It was made of metal, and it was delivered to King Shalva. So he used this spaceship that he got from Maya Danava, the engineer of the forces of darkness in the universe, and he used this airplane to attack the city of Dwarka, which was one of the cities occupied by the forces of goodness and light. You could say it was the city of Lord Krishna, who, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, is the supreme conscious being. So King Shalva used this spaceship to attack the city of Dwarka, and there are elaborate descriptions of this spaceship in the Bhagavat Purana, or Srimad Bhagavatam, as it's sometimes called. It's one of the historical writings of ancient India. And there are very elaborate descriptions of this spacecraft. It's said that Shalva used energy beam weapons, which were like thunderbolts, to attack the city of Dwarka. He was using it to set fires in the city and destroy the opposing forces. And it said that this spaceship that he had would appear in several places at once. In other words, duplicate images of it would appear in different places simultaneously, so that the defenders of the city of Dwarka who were trying to shoot it down couldn't do it. And in that sense, this spaceship possessed technology reminiscent of modern military technology, you know, whereby a military that's attacking another country with warheads from missiles, you know, that come in from outer space, you know, they design the warheads so that they can project false images to the enemy's radar systems that are trying to detect it. So the spaceship of King Shalva had this ability to appear in many different places simultaneously and confuse the defenders who were trying to shoot it down. And it's also stated that this spacecraft was able to move in all different directions by the power of mind. And again, this is something that's reminiscent of modern military technology. Today's jet fighter aircraft move at such high speeds that it becomes very difficult to control them in battle situations simply by hand. So our military and other militaries around the world have developed technologies whereby a pilot can control the aircraft, the high-speed jet aircraft, mentally or by eye movements that are detected by, you know, computer. So it was, yeah, it's very interesting to find descriptions of these kinds of things in ancient writings going back thousands of years. So eventually it was shot down, this spacecraft. But it's just one of the many descriptions of flying craft and spaceships that are found in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India.
Do the people of India take these Sanskrit writings as history or myth or a mixture of the two, or how do they look at it?
Well, one thing we have to consider is that for many centuries, India was controlled by the British. You know, it was part of their empire. Mm-hmm. You know, they had come there originally just for trading, but you know, eventually their military came as well, and they made India into a colony in the British Empire. And as part of that, they established an education system, which is still operating today. So you find a variety of opinion in India about these things. There are large numbers of people who take very seriously the accounts of human history and human civilizations and advances in technology that are described in the ancient Sanskrit writings, especially the Puranas or the histories. Also, the epics like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. You know, they contain descriptions of weapons resembling modern nuclear weapons. They were called Brahmastras. They contain accounts of flying craft. They were called Vimanas. They contain all kinds of information like that. So there's a segment of the population that accepts these things very literally, but you could also find, you know, segments of the population that regard such things as mythological.
It's kind of hard to believe people could just make up stuff like this. It seems like you would have had to have a different frame of reference even to be thinking of extraterrestrial craft and holograms and flying cities and, you know, all this amazing technology if they didn't see something, you know.
Well, that's the way that I certainly look at it. you know, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, the Vedic literature, is a repository of all kinds of knowledge. The most essential part of it is understanding the real nature of human life. I mean, today, most scientists would say that a human being or any other living thing is just a machine made of molecules. And as far as consciousness and mind are concerned, those are just temporary byproducts of bioelectrical activity in the brain. And most scientists today would say when the chemical reactions in the brain stop at the time of death, then there's no more consciousness, no more life, nothing. There's nothing. You just evaporate into nothingness. So
weird.
The You know, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India have a different idea about consciousness, that it has its own independent existence apart from matter. They would say consciousness is not produced by chemicals in the brain. Consciousness does not evolve up from matter. Rather, consciousness has its own independent existence. It's neither created nor destroyed, but it can come into contact with matter and become covered by it. But then, if consciousness identifies with the temporary covering of matter, you know, that we call a body, then it experiences some discomfort, because if you identify with something that you're not, then you get into feelings of discomfort. And the purpose of life is to restore, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, the purpose of life is to restore consciousness to its original pure state, free of its contact with matter. So that is the most essential truth, you know, that can be found in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And of course, this idea that consciousness has its own independent existence means that at the time of the death of this covering that we call the body, you know, the conscious self continues to exist. Now, if it has some material desires remaining, unfulfilled material desires, then it will get another material covering. I think before we were talking a little bit about reincarnation. Yeah, so the conscious self, if it retains material desires, will continue to reincarnate on this level of reality, lifetime after lifetime, until finally its material desires are exhausted and it can return to the eternal state of pure consciousness on a higher level of reality, and the cycle of reincarnation thus ends.
So we're in the material world because we need to learn more before we move on to higher levels?
Something like that. The original constitutional position of the conscious self is to exist on a higher level of reality that I call the level of pure consciousness. And in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, it's called the world of Brahman, Brahman being a word for the spiritual essence. So on that higher level of reality, all conscious selves and on that higher level of reality, all conscious selves exist in harmony with each other. They are all engaged cooperatively along with the source of all conscious beings. It's a level of reality dominated by the mood of loving harmony. But if a conscious self becomes egotistical, domineering, exploiting, selfish, it can no longer exist on that higher level of reality. You know, there must be some alternative reality where it can act out its desires to exploit and dominate and control others for its own selfish purposes. And that's the level of reality that we currently inhabit. And we're confronted with two choices. We can get more and more deeply involved in attempts to dominate, control, and exploit others. Or we can try to understand that we're all beings of pure consciousness. There's no need to divide ourselves up into so many competing groups. No need to try to dominate, control, and exploit each other in that way. We can learn how to satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, efficient, and fair way possible, while putting most of our human energy into developing that resource of consciousness and trying to elevate our consciousness back to the state where we can exist on that higher level of pure consciousness.
You know what I just thought of? It? We need to get you to speak, to cover this topic and speak in front of like the U.S. Congress or the Bilderberger Group and change some of those people's orientations, I think, a little bit. Anyway.
Well, maybe some of them are listening to this podcast, to this show.
They might.
You never know.
That would be great. So is there no conflict at the highest levels of reality then?
Not of the kind that we see acted out on this level of reality. I mean, you might have competition to see who can be the best at something. Sometimes you see that kind of thing acted out in sporting events, maybe in a tennis match, there's conflict, you could say, in a tennis match. One tennis player is trying to defeat the other, but they play the game according to the rules, and at the end, they shake hands. Whoever won or lost that time, there'll be another game. But it's not like, the kind of vicious competition and conflict that we observe in so many different ways. We see conflict among individuals, murders and things like that, conflict among genders, conflict among classes, conflict among races, conflict among nations, conflict among religions even. Mm-hmm. That is not of the type of, let's have like a sporting event where after it's all over, everybody shakes hands and goes on. But I mean, really vicious conflict. I don't want to get into the details of it because, we're all familiar with it. Sure. We see it all around us happening on so many different levels. But on that higher level, there can be competition, but it's a friendly sort of competition.
Mm-hmm. Did you say that the Lord Krishna lived on the earth at one time?
In the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there's the concept of avatar. Ah. Avatar. There was a Hollywood film called Avatar once.
Right.
But that's a Sanskrit word, and avatar means one who comes from a higher level down to a lower level. And in this case, especially for the purpose of giving enlightenment and knowledge. So although the conscious selves come down to this level of reality, to the world of matter, the supreme conscious self will also come to remind them of their original nature and offer them the chance to revive that original nature and return to the level of pure consciousness. So that same concept is found in many different spiritual traditions. It's there in Buddhism. They have the idea of bodhisattvas, enlightened beings who come to this world. It's there in Christianity. It's there in Islam. It's there in most, you know, ancient wisdom traditions. You know, the idea that although we are in this world of matter, the higher being who is our source, original source, makes some effort to communicate with us, even though we've departed from our original position. So yes, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, the Supreme Conscious Being, who has many names, one of them being Krishna, does come to this world. And that's when that manifestation of the Supreme Conscious Being in this world is called avatar, meaning that although ultimately that Supreme Conscious Being is completely transcendental to this world, completely beyond it, still to give knowledge and illumination and out of compassion, the avatar manifests here.
I don't know if this would be a correct thing to say, but is Krishna almost like the universal consciousness in a way?
Yes. In this sense, there's, I mean, when we look at ourselves, we see that we're conscious, we're individual, we're personal. You know, I have my identity, I'm conscious, you have your identity, you're conscious. Mm-hmm. We could say the same for each of our listeners. We're conscious, we're individual, and we're personal. And to me, that suggests that our source is also conscious, individual, and personal. So that original conscious, individual, and personal source of us all is given in the cosmology of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, the name Krishna. And so in that sense, yes, Krishna is the universal consciousness and we're part of it. But the difference is I'm conscious of what goes on in my head and my body. You're conscious primarily of what goes on in your head and heart and body. Everyone, each individual is conscious of what goes on in their head, heart, and body. But Krishna is conscious of everything that goes on within all of our hearts, heads, and bodies. So in that sense, you could say the consciousness of Krishna is universal.
So in each lifetime where we reincarnate, do you think our personality is a little different each time because we grow up with a new set of influences and we're in a different time and a different environment in the next lifetime. So it's almost like we're kind of a different person in each lifetime in a sense. Would you agree with that or not?
In a sense, I agree. And I would explain it like this. The goal of the whole process is to be 100% in the consciousness of one's original state. Now, when a conscious self enters the world of matter, it takes on different forms or bodies made of matter according to its level of awareness. So, say in one lifetime, one becomes 5% conscious of one's constitutional state. And then in the next incarnation, one will take up at that point at 5%. And maybe add another 5%, and in the next life another 5%. Mm-hmm. When it adds up to 100% after so many lifetimes, then the conscious self can get out of that cycle of birth and death, the cycle of reincarnation, and be situated on the platform of eternal consciousness. So yes, in one lifetime after another, we become different in the sense that we become more and more aware. In other words, there's a process of spiritual evolution. So in that sense, there's progress. Another way to look at it is in terms of like an actor. You know, an actor or actress has a personality apart from whatever roles it's playing, he or she is playing in particular films. And in particular films, you know, the actor or actress takes on many, many different roles, but really is the same person in a sense. You know, there's an original personality.
Right.
And of course, sometimes it becomes problematic for actors. You know, they become so absorbed in their roles that they forget who they really are originally in terms of their personality, and they have to go into analysis or psychotherapy to recover.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. That's pretty interesting that someone can get so wrapped up in a role that they're playing that they can't even pull themselves away from it.
Yeah. So similarly, in the course of reincarnation, you know, we take on different roles, and in that sense, you could say, as you were hinting, you're a different person, but you have an original personality, and as I was saying, one can make progress in each reincarnation towards realizing what that original personality is. And that would be the goal of the whole thing, to understand that.
Do the Vedic writings say that a person is recognizable from one incarnation to the next?
Somebody has to keep track of the person, yeah.
So, I mean, if
yeah, there's some system in the cosmos for overseeing the progress that conscious selves make lifetime after lifetime. And you know, it's just like, you know, if you're in a frequent flyer program, you know, for airlines, you know, somebody's keeping track of your progress, you know, to gold status or platinum status or million mile status. So there is some system in the cosmos for maintaining oversight of, well, this conscious self is now in this position, and in the next life it's in that position, and it's acquired this much knowledge or realization. And when you've acquired enough, then you get the privileges of the status of being freed, you know, from, you know, the cycle of reincarnation. So yeah, there's some system arranged by the Supreme Conscious Self for tracking, you could say, each conscious self in its journey through the cycle of reincarnation.
Do you think they would be physically recognizable? In other words, could you look at, you know, person A when they lived, say, from the year 1000 to the year 1100, and then the person comes back, you know, maybe in the year 1300 to the 1400, and do you think that there would be a similarity where you could say, hey, these two people look alike? Do you think that sort of thing happens?
Well, there are many cases where people feel some connection with each other, and that, you know, they've known each other from some other life. Now, how they recognize that exactly, I'm not completely sure. Mm-hmm. According to the ancient Sanskrit writings, each conscious self has its original form of pure consciousness. It's called the Swarupa. Mm. Rupa means form. Swa means self. Or, you know, so it means you have your own real form. You know, just like, you know, the actor may play many different roles and be made up in many different ways. And if you knew the original form of the actor, what the actor looked like without all the makeup and the big nose stuck on and wig and everything, you might be able to tell, oh, yeah, that's this actor in this costume, the same actor in another costume. But that would depend upon your knowing the original form.
That's interesting. That's very, very interesting.
So the problem with most of us now is we can't perceive the real form of the people in our lives. We don't see that. And I mean, that's, you know, because any material form, it comes into being, it persists for some time, and then it is destroyed. It disintegrates. Like in this lifetime, you know, I started out as a little baby, you know, I became 5 years old, you know, I became a teenager, you know, I became a young adult, I became a middle-aged person. Now I've kind of entered into the elderly stage. So if somebody were looking at me, just looking at the body, they wouldn't be seeing the real self. And, you know, sometimes it takes some shocking event for a person to understand I'm not really seeing my friend or my husband or my wife. You know, sometimes the shock comes there at the wake or the funeral, you know, where you see the body being either lowered into the ground or put into the crematorium or whatever. And then you realize I never really saw the person that I loved. You know, so sometimes, you know, we have to understand what is, who is the person really in their original form of pure consciousness that is animating this material body that I now see before me, because that material body is only going to last a certain period of time. And then that conscious self within that body is going to go somewhere else. Now, it could either go back to its original form of pure consciousness, if it's qualified to do that, in which case, if you were able to perceive that person on that level of reality, it would be an eternal experience. It wouldn't ever change. But if we're talking about perceiving that conscious self in its original form when it's covered you know, by some temporary material form, that's another thing. Now, there are personalities who can do that, but they have to be, they would be persons of a very high level of spiritual awareness that would be able to perceive the identity of the conscious self that may be in the body of a dog or a cat or another human being. You know, it's a very high level of awareness to be able to do that, but it's possible.
That's very interesting. So I know we're running out of time here. I don't want to keep us too much longer. How do the yuga cycles play into all this reincarnation we've been talking about? Like right now we're living in the Kali Yuga, which I think is the age of darkness, right?
Yes. Yeah. The time concept of the cosmological writings of ancient India is cyclical. And we're all aware of cycles. There's the day-night cycle. You know, during the day we do certain things. During the night we do other things. We're aware of the cycle of the seasons. In the temperate areas of the world, there is spring and then summer and then fall and then winter. And in the different seasons, we adapt our activities. We wear different types of clothes. We do different kinds of sports. You know, we do different things according to the season. But, you know, the ancient people of India were aware of even larger cycles of time, and they were called yugas. And basically, there's a cycle of four yugas. The cycle starts with a golden age. It's called the Satya Yuga. And in that age, people are very spiritual. They're very unified. In the next age, called the Treta Yuga, people become a little bit materialistic. They begin dividing themselves up into classes and groups and living not so close to nature. They start living in cities. And then in the next stage, called the Dwapara Yuga, things deteriorate a little bit more. And, you know, there's organized conflict, wars, and things like that. Economic development going on in a big way. People have become a little bit less spiritual. And then finally, there's the age of Kali, which we've entered now, which is described in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India as being a time of ever-increasing social and environmental disturbance and degradation. And we sort of see that playing out around us in the world. But it's also an opportunity. You know, say, just because it's raining, it doesn't mean you have to get wet. Mm-hmm. So yes, we may be in an age of darkness where there's more and more hypocrisy. I mean, there are elaborate predictions in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India of what the age of Kali will be like. It says to get justice, you have to have money. Governments will exploit, you know, their people and make them very unhappy. You know, there are elaborate descriptions of what will happen, that the deserts will expand, you know, the animals will become extinct and things like that. And it's all happening around us just as predicted. But as I said, just because it's raining, it doesn't mean you have to get wet. You know, you can shelter yourself, you can shelter others, and make use of the opportunity to try to become completely self-realized, you know, realize one's eternal nature as a being of pure consciousness.
Well, Michael, thank you again for a fascinating show. I want you to have some time to tell people again about your books and anything else you want to mention.
Okay. If people are interested in my work, you know, they can go to my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com, and there they can learn about upcoming interviews, upcoming lectures in April 2018, from April 12th to April 15th. I'll be at a conference in South Africa called the Ubuntu Conference, organized by Michael Tellinger and some other folks there. So if people want to learn about my upcoming speaking events, they can also check out the website, the schedule link. And people can also learn about my books on my website. Of course, there's the classic Forbidden Archaeology with cases of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity. Then there's my book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And in that book, I talk about the nature of the conscious self, how we don't evolve up from matter. We devolve or come down from spirit or the level of pure consciousness. I talk in that book about the evidence for a conscious self that can exist apart from the body made of matter. I get into the whole topic of reincarnation, as we've been talking about on the show. And my most recent published book is My Science, My Religion, which is a collection of papers that I've presented on these topics at mainstream scientific conferences. So if people are interested in learning more about my work, they can go to that website, mcremo.com. And if they go to the order page for a book, you know, they'll find a special offer that anyone who gets a copy of my book, My Science, My Religion, will also receive a free copy of Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the most widely read books from the ancient culture of India. So that free offer is there. If anyone buys a copy of my latest book, My Science, My Religion, they'll also have the opportunity to request a free copy of the book Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the inspirations for my work.
Thank you. I appreciate talking to you. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Okay.
Have a good evening, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.